But tonight we have seven speakers, and to kick it off, Abel Russ, 2L, is going to speak called Anarchism and Law.
Thanks. Thanks, Leslie, for the introduction. I wanted to talk about anarchism and law for this because I think I'm probably an anarchist, and I'm probably going to be a lawyer. And I felt like I was violating a law of physics or something, because you're not supposed to put those two things together. They don't really mix. But I also wanted to dispel some, I feel, mischaracterizations of anarchism that people have, misconceptions. A lot of people think of the Smash the State thing or the Black Bloc in the Seattle protest, and that's an important part of the anarchist history, but it's really not definitive at all. For me, for example, I don't know if you guys know who Marlo Thomas is and the Free to Be You and Me record that she made, and that's sort of how I think of anarchism. I think of it as a real warm and fuzzy kind of thing. So I'm going to try to go through why I think so. And if I were going to do it right, I would talk about anarchist groups and what they do, because it's really, the philosophy is opposed to leaders in a way, and so more what groups do together. But just in order to get these ideas out on the table, I'm going to go through seven white men in a very straight historical way. It started, what we call anarchism today, I think, started in Europe in the 19th century as one wing of socialism. There was Marx, and then there were all these other people who were saying, we don't support capitalism, but we also don't trust government, so we want to do something else that's totally different. And so the first two people I'm going to talk about were responding to Marx in a lot of ways. Proudhon was a French guy. He was a printer, and he was a member of the French Assembly, so he's an anarchist who's in government, so there's already a sense of some overlap. But he's famous for, A, I think being the first person to call himself an anarchist publicly, a big figure to do it, and B, for saying that property is theft, which was kind of a radical idea, threw a lot of people off. But what he actually meant when you read what he was writing is that profit is theft. Everybody's entitled to a certain amount of property. The stuff you can work with your own labor is legitimate property. But there's a lot of illegitimate property. For example, something you own where all the profit comes out of somebody else's labor and then you just take the profit. That he would call theft. So he proposed a mutual banking system where everybody would get loans at an interest rate that only covered administrative costs. Nobody would be making money off the loans. Everybody would be getting credit if they needed it. Michael, who's Russian, Bakunin, was a pretty flamboyant figure, and he gave the libertarian color to the libertarian socialism of the 19th century, which is what another way that anarchism was characterized. And I'm just going to read one quote that he said. He was really into diversity of people. He thought that would make a better society, and he thought it would be better for individuals and better for community if we had free associations instead of government. But he also said the ideal society would be one where you could do one thing today and another tomorrow. You could hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, criticize after dinner, without ever becoming hunter, fisherman, shepherd, or critic. And that was pretty definitive of his philosophy. And both Proudhon and Bakunin were critical of Marx because Marx was so enamored of a vanguard party. And more than Marx, people who came after Marx were really into the vanguard party. And they thought you could have certain leaders who will teach everybody else what's right. They'll take over the state power in the name of the proletariat and everything will be better. And Bakunin and Proudhon were both saying, I don't think that's a good idea. We don't ourselves want to say that we have the right answer. We don't want to be apostles of a new religion. That's the way Proudhon said it. Or Bakunin said, we don't want to work out plans for future conditions. They were a little more modest, but they did want to sort of get the ball rolling and get people on the same page and work together to make it happen. So that's those two. Leo Tolstoy, who wrote War and Peace, Anna Karenina, is another famous anarchist, and he's maybe the figurehead of the pacifist wing of the anarchist movement, which is my favorite part, and I think the best, the part that's the most internally consistent. He was a Christian, but he didn't believe in religion or the church. He drew his inspiration from the teachings of Christ as he saw them, and then worked it into this pacifist thing that he wrote about quite a bit. He said in a couple of great essays about patriotism that patriotism is immoral. And I it's a tough pill to swallow in a way, because patriotism seems like such a good idea to a lot of people, but he's Tolstoy, so he can make a really good argument that he's right, and I believe him after reading that. Peter Kropotkin, another Russian, he was a geographer first. Right after Darwin published Origin of Species and was talking about natural selection and survival of the fittest, a lot of social theorists in England and other parts of Europe were using that to say that people should be competing. Survival of the fittest among people would be the best way to achieve a good society. And Kropotkin responded to that in a couple of ways. Before that ever happened, I think independently of that, he had been traveling around Siberia and he noticed that within a species, there's really not that much competition. There's a lot of competition between species and sometimes within a species. But there's also a lot of cooperation going on. And so he did this exhaustive inventory. He didn't think of this idea himself, but you know, from his observations and other people have been writing about it, he put together a great list of examples of animal communities, human communities, where cooperation really has conferred an evolutionary advantage. And in fact, Darwin had said something like that. And evolutionary biologists today accept that as just part of science. There's competition and cooperation, they both contribute to evolutionary advantage. And so we have instinctive tendencies in both directions. Kropotkin also wrote the Encyclopedia Britannica entry for anarchism in 1911. He was one of the best at imagining the future, what it might look like. And he pictured an interwoven network of free associations that allow people to achieve full development of their potential, intellectual, moral, creative, all of that. To get into the 20th century and on this continent, Paul Goodman, just to name an example of somebody from the 60s, 70s, was, he died in 1972, so not much in the 70s. He was a pacifist and an anarchist, and he was a figurehead for the New Left, or he was critical of the New Left in some ways because the SDS and student group movements in the 60s, because they had a lot of Marxist tendencies. They would try to force confrontations and radicalize people, and he thought that was kind of manipulative. But he was supportive of the tendencies they had to encourage participatory democracy, more radical forms of democracy. I'm trying to find a good quote from him, but I'll skip that. Now, two more. Murray Bookchin was an ecologist and a factory worker who became an anarchist. He started out as a kid as a communist, but eventually became an anarchist. And he founded the Institute for Social Ecology at Goddard College here in Vermont. And he's a cool guy. He merged environmental and anarchist themes really well. And he came to the conclusion that all of our ecological problems originate in deeper problems that are also creating social problems for us, like domination, coercion. So he was allied with feminists and eco-feminists and people that see man dominating nature as a real problem. And he spoke of anarchism as a very ethical, high ethical standard, because it insists that freedom is only, and this he got from Bakunin and other people too, you only really attain freedom if you're fulfilling your responsibility to other people in the community to let them attain the same freedom. So he saw it as a very demanding ethic, but one that he supported. And finally, Noam Chomsky, I just want to mention him because he's the only one of these people that's still alive. He's brilliant. He's a linguist. He's an anarchist. He's really smart. And he's also really modest, and he doesn't claim a lot of new ideas for himself, but he is good at synthesizing and applying old ideas to new conditions. And the only thing I want to say about him, he's written a ton about social structures and anarchist theory and anarchist history, but he's been good at differentiating between his long-term goal, which is to move beyond the state as a structure that organizes us, and his short-term goals, which in some cases include strengthening parts of the state that allow us to have opportunities to experiment and move towards a new future. So, just to wrap that all up, anarchists typically believe in decentralized power, they reject profit and economic growth, they really like cooperation, they're really nice. And co-ops, I think food co-ops are the best example of anarchists. They're really revolutionary because they take profit out of food distribution, for one thing, but they also give a really good place for people to experiment with group decision-making in a non-hierarchical, loose, inefficient way, which is way more fun and better. So now I'm going to go to the law part. Probably running out of time.
You're good.
I think there are two ways. There have been two ways for me especially where legal education and the legal culture that I think we're about to walk into is really, there's a lot of friction between that and anarchism. And the first one is that since we're in an adversarial system, and John's going to talk more about this, we have to practice a lot of skills like competing, lying, obstructing, intimidating. And it's really hard to do that if you're also the kind of person who's trying to practice cooperation and being nice and, you know, listening to people and being patient. And it creates a lot of dissonance psychologically, and I think maybe that's why we all get drinking problems. But it's also, I mean, that tension is also, John's probably going to talk about this, but it's a really destructive thing that we practice the skills of competition, and I hope we, for those of us who think this is a big deal, we should just get out there and not act that way to the extent that we can. The second problem between the conflict between law and anarchism is that law really supports capitalism in a lot of ways. You can see it in the fact that capitalism concentrates power in the form of money, and then those people have better access to legal assistance and the law. You can see capitalist values in everything that we learn in school, from decisions that are made on the basis of efficiency, to Coase's theorem, to what else was I going to say about that? The alienability of property always blew me away. I mean, the law really does promote capitalism, and so we're going to get stuck in that role too, and that's kind of a problem if you don't support capitalism. And finally, our legal culture tends to reduce everything to property rights, and that's overly simplistic, and it's counterproductive if you think we should be focusing on higher forms of organization like communities and societies at large, or ecological communities. I'm not sure if there's a way you can put these two together, but I think that the idea that we might reform the system by getting in there and promoting human rights, it's important that we do that, but it's kind of like putting out fires. I don't think it's really as radical as an anarchist philosophy would suggest that we should be doing. We could try to make changes at the policy level if we get that high up. And for example, judges over the course of history, Eric Freyfogel pointed this out recently, something I was reading, have redefined property rights whenever they see that there's some kind of major social harm that they have to avoid. So for example, discrimination in places of public accommodations in the 19th century, or what was the other one recently? Prior appropriation of water rights, I was just working on that recently, or strip mining in Kentucky. Those are all cases where the courts have redefined property rights to say, we're taking away one of the sticks out of your bundle, but you just shouldn't have it, and we're going to make sure that's not part of property. So there's that thing you can do, but that's not even really enough, I don't think, because it's still sort of conceding that the system as it stands is pretty good. So I think the most fundamental thing we can do is not identify ourselves too much with our role as a lawyer, because we're going to come into a lot of conflicts and contradictions. And to avoid that, I think it's probably better to just see ourselves as citizens with law degrees, and eventually we're not going to be in the position where that's useful to us anymore. And I think at some point, if you come into enough conflicts where you're compromising on your morals, quit. Don't be a lawyer anymore. It's only temporary. It's not that important. That's all. Thanks.